Jim Shoemaker, Ted Miner, Scott Jordan, and Steve Anderson are registered representatives and investment advisor representatives of Securian Financial Services, Inc., securities dealer, member FINRA, SIPC, a registered investment advisor. Shoemaker Financial is independently owned and operated.
Helping you make the most of your money, it's time for Talk Money. Now, your host, Jim Shoemaker.
Whether you're a baby boomer or a millennial, it doesn't seem to matter. A common concern is always money. Well, welcome to today's program. We've got a great program lined up for you today. And if guests remind you, if you got questions, send them to Jim, 901-683-0989, or send them to talkmoney@shoemakerfinancial.com. Bert has asked us a question. And Bert, I know you were listening to last week's program. His question, Scott, duties of an executor.
Well, that's a great question. Bert asked that, is that
Bert,
correct?
Yeah, yes,
that is a great question, and we didn't really dive into a lot of details on that. As a matter of fact, we may need to do a segment on a show one day
that really goes into more detail
on all this. But in general, the executor is responsible for settling the deceased estate. So, you know, I would say start with getting a copy of the will, so you're going to need that. If all you have is a copy, you're probably going to need to find the original. That could be stored somewhere by the deceased or possibly at their attorney's office. But in a lot of cases, you will need an original copy of that will. So that I would start with getting that document because that's going to be your instructions of what you have to do. And then you got to really start organizing the estate. You know, I would probably make a list of the assets and liabilities and look at what all's involved in this estate. You're going to need to put an ad in the newspaper that alerts any creditors that are out there that the deceased has passed away so that if there are any claims against the estate, they can bring those against the estate. So, and then you'll also have to pay those claims. So it's getting everything organized, getting a list, paying off the creditors, and then you have to file tax returns for the estate. And finally, you know, you have to distribute the property to the people who are beneficiaries of the estate. So a lot goes on in all that. You need to keep very accurate records of everything you're doing as the executor of the estate. And, you know, I always recommend there's a cost to this, but in a lot of cases, it may be beneficial to hire an attorney to help you with the selling of the
estate. When you talk about doing that, I think from Bert's standpoint, I don't think he was talking about the executor for his spouse. It's more like I've been named executor for a friend,
yeah, family member,
like that.
Yeah, so there's a lot of work involved. It can be very simple in a case of a simple, you know, estate where there's not a lot of assets and liabilities. It can go very quickly, but in more complicated situations, there's a lot of work to be done. And like I said, sometimes spending the extra money to hire an experienced attorney that knows how to walk you through the estate settlement process is well worth the money.
Keep in mind now, financial professionals, just to remind everybody, we don't provide specific tax or legal advice or information. Should not be considered that what we're talking about should not be considered as such. Always consult your tax legal advisor regarding your own specific tax and legal advice. Let me introduce my other guests. Ted Miner's in the studio and Steve Anderson. Steve, I know you've got a comment about what we're talking about because this is so important for all of us. We're dealing with this all the time.
Yeah, one of the things that's become a big topic recently in the estate world is digital assets. You start thinking about your subscription to Netflix or Amazon or your iCloud for your iPhone or whatever, your email account and all that. One of the things that I thought was really interesting is I heard from an attorney recently that if you just share your passwords with everybody and you pass away and then they go in there and log in, that's actually not legal, right? So password sharing is not a legal strategy. So just since we're talking about it, it's really important that we all get a digital power of attorney that gives explicit rights to that property. And apparently that's a big thing in the legal world now is discussion around that, like when can Apple transfer your iCloud to the next of kin or whoever? So something to keep in mind.
I think that's critical and I think that's important. And I, you know, as I'm listening to you, it's already opened up this huge volume of things we probably do. Bert's asked a great question and we need to go to that and thought process and put a whole program around that.
And I think what Steve just brought up, that just highlights the need to update estate plans periodically because that's not something that maybe if you had your documents drafted even 10 years ago that was really at the forefront. And so it may be time to revisit those documents and see if we need to put some stuff in there that handles the digital assets and things of that nature.
You know, but also what he mentioned just about the passwords is a huge critical issue today. And yeah. I was fortunate enough to have a client that had kept a book, and he gave it to his wife, and it had everything in there. And I just went, wow, that was great for her. It made it a lot easier for her. If you can imagine going on to your husband or wife's computer and not have their passwords and try to negotiate. I'm just trying to think of all the websites I've got with a password.
I don't even want to think about
yeah,
it. You know,
man, it's
terrible. But but you're saying that, and again, I think we're becoming aware. But I think Bert's question is, what do I do? I mean, it's awareness is part of it. Sometimes we don't know what we don't know. But as you're aware of what you've got to do, how do you begin to put it and implement it? That's kind of what I'm hearing maybe from that question. And I appreciate you guys doing that. I want to remind everybody again, if you want to find our show, simply just go to Talk Money on an Apple Podcast, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts. Search for Talk Money with Jim Shoemaker. And we appreciate you just signing up for the program. We thank you for that. Now, let me introduce the rest of the program. I mean, Ted Miner, you've heard from Ted, you've heard from Steve, you've heard from Scott. We're going to talk about choosing retirement strategies and thoughts about the recent banking system. In the latter part of the program, we have with us Dr. Jim Whitmire, Minister of Music at Crossroads Baptist Church. He's going to talk about the upcoming celebration called the 2023 Passion Play. You don't want to miss that. He's a frequent guest of ours about this time every year. And we're looking forward to hearing what he's going to talk about, what happens at Crossroads and Mid-America Baptist Theological Seminary. So that's the program. Let me go now. I'm interested, but I hope we kind of covered Bert's question. We've agreed that we've got to come back and get into that a little bit more in the weeds to help people understand. That's what we'll do, Scott. We'll put that program together. But Steve Anderson, I think it is important because there's a question, a concern, all about this Valley Bank in the Silicon Valley. It goes bankrupt. You know, we got bank failure. It's the second worst bank failure in U.S. history. I mean, you go all through this process. I mean, you know, yet we're not dealing with the same scenario of Washington Mutual failure in 2008. This is not a credit crisis. This is Silicon Valley Bank. Well, we could say poorly managed and things like that, but I want to kind of, if you could, just kind of describe a bank. Really put it in perspective. What's a bank do?
Yeah, that's talk about getting in the weeds. How long we got here?
Ask Tyler.
Most of us know our banking relationship is we go to the bank, we put money in, we take money out. I mean, that's we don't ever like learn this stuff. So this may sound remedial, but you know, when you go put money in a bank, in actual reality, you're loaning the bank money. You're loaning them money and they owe you that money back. But hopefully we all know this, that the money doesn't sit at the bank. They take that money and they do one of three or four different things with it. Number one, they can keep some of it in reserve, some of it in a safe, essentially. Another option is they can take some of that money and loan it out. So Scott deposits money in the bank. The bank loans it to me to buy my house. It's a wonderful life. Old George Bailey. Ted was talking about that before the show. And so they can loan that money out to start a business, real estate, whatever. But when they do that, they're performing a very important function for the economy. They're taking a dollar and they're making it worth a lot more dollars. And their job is to make sure that who they're giving that to is responsible. And then the third thing they can do is they can buy bonds or other securities, whether it be treasury securities or whatever, but they can buy corporate bonds, treasury, U.S. Treasury bonds. But they take that money and they do something with it, so it's not sitting there. But that's, in general, they take deposits, they make loans, and that's what they're trying to do. And the goal is they want to pay you a little bit, and they want to loan it so they get paid interest on that loan that's greater than what they're paying you.
That's called making a profit.
That's right.
And again, I think it's important. You're talking about circulation of money.
Yep.
And they're circulating that. They're taking a dollar, and ultimately that dollar will be circulated enough to become $10.
That's the goal.
I mean, I'm just speculating. I'm not saying it does become $10. That'd be nice if we do that every time we do. But the reality is the bank is not required, but in their management program, their whole thought process, the board, everybody, they're loaning, they're depositing, but they're keeping money. They're not holding it in a little safe back there in the back room with all the money that they collect every day coming in that way.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. The money comes in, it goes out. Some of it's there, but most of it's going out elsewhere.
I have a quote from a particular individual that I think is kind of speaks a little bit here. It says, "I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies.
My goodness, I didn't know we were going to go that direction.
That's harsh.
I mean, you know, that's a pretty strong. Now, we just described a banking system in America today that functions to get the supply of money moving around. But this is a person that we all respect and all have a high standing for him. I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies.
Well, as we talked about this before the show, Jim, the context is important here.
Yes, it is. It's Thomas Jefferson, 1802. I think it's important, though, yeah, that the vision that our forefathers had and looking back and saying, we don't want the banks to be in total control because what you just said, they're controlling money flow.
Yeah, and actually, if you go back to about the 1930s, before the 1930s, when you put money in a bank, you were trusting that money was going to be there. And it was a much more open relationship. I mean, you didn't really know. But in the 30s...
You trusted your banker.
You trusted your banker, yeah. And I imagine they were like close family, you know.
The old West knew that the money was there. Billy the Kid, they knew the money was there
by force, right?
That's right. That's
but
right.
See, in the 30s, coming out of the Great Depression era, this thing called FDIC insurance was introduced, and it said that okay, if you've got $1,000 in the bank and your money's coming in from paycheck, you're paying bills and everything, we want to guarantee some amount of that money through this FDIC insurance, and so that number's now $250,000. And we'll talk more about the Silicon Valley Bank specifically, but interesting fact, over 90% of the money at Silicon Valley Bank, according to Wall Street Journal, was actually above the $250,000 limit. So what we're talking about is huge companies with gobs of cash sitting in the bank way above that limit. And those companies were largely tech companies. That's an oversimplification, but they were quick, fast-growing companies that were large benefactors of that post-COVID era. And so when all of a sudden money started getting tight, their operations needed to start pulling out cash, and so they started pulling out cash. And of course, we already established that Silicon Valley Bank, like every bank, they didn't have all that money sitting in deposits, so they had to start selling things, and that's where the cascading effect started. That's where the trouble really started for them.
And that's basically where the Fed had to step in and do some things put some end to that.
Yeah, and I think they acted quickly, and I think that was good, by basically coming in, you know, with the Bank Term Funding Program and saying, because the problem is when they had to start selling their assets is because of the interest rate rises, their assets weren't worth as much as they paid for them. So the situation comes, and I think the loss was somewhere around $1.8 billion on one of their asset sales. And that kind of got everybody's attention. But the Fed really stepped in quickly with the Bank Term Funding Program that allows banks to borrow against those assets at full par value. Now, we can argue all day long about the rightness or wrongness or political correctness of all that, but at the end of the day, that does help ease everybody's mind, especially in the banking sector, that at least I know I can go borrow against these assets at full value and not have to sell them at a loss.
And you say that, you know, I think, Scott and Steve, you guys are going through this process. I guess I want to ask this question. Is 2008 and 2009 similar to, what are we going through today? Similar because investors, whether we like it or not, we get shaken and we panic and we do things sometimes that we shouldn't do during that mode. And that's what I want us to make sure that we're helping people understand. Is this similar, like, you know, possible to the 08 and 09 credit crisis?
Yeah, and in one distinct way, I would say this is tremendously different, and it's a good different. So in 2008, 2009, these banks, you know, the bank takes money, they put a little bit in their safe, they loan some, and they buy bonds. Well, the money they were loaning in 2008, 2009, there was a history, a buildup of not really underwriting those loans super well. So they were making risky loans. Those loans, most banks, once they do loans, they take bunches of those loans and they package them together, and that's what ends up in some of these bonds. So these banks were making poor loans. In some cases, they were creating bonds that had poor loans. And so there was what's called a credit problem. The underwriting risk was that all these loans would default, and it was a very real risk in 2008, 2009. Silicon Valley Bank suffered the same problem that the bond market had last year. Worst year ever in the bond market. The bond market, Barclays aggregate index was down 13-ish%. Interest rates went up 1,800%. Silicon Valley Bank had not bad loans, not bad bonds. They had U.S. treasuries. But those treasuries, Ted mentioned it before the before we got on air, that those a lot of those treasuries dropped 20% and 30% last year.
Yeah.
So it's good debt that that Silicon Valley owns. It's just worth a lot less than they paid for it.
It's just not liquid.
There you go. It's a liquidity problem this time instead of a credit problem. It's a problem, but it's a much better problem.
All right, better problem. Dodd-Frank, if you remember, in the 08-09 crisis, really was supposed to come in and regulate some of these problems that we're talking about. Now, Ted, you mentioned earlier that when we think about this regulation and the restriction that was going on, how do you see that similar? Are we going to see another Dodd-Frank bill come out of this? Or is it just the fact that the bump in the road, what's actually happened, enough that it's going to restrict the money flow, slow us down, and put us in probably a mild recession? Just thoughts.
I think if the government steps in and takes the responsibility for these loans, otherwise if they're going to make them whole, then they're probably going to require some things in return for it, which is automatically going to restrict things.
Okay, so restriction is going to happen. We expect that.
Yeah, and on top of that, we were talking about this too, that that $250,000 limit, I'd started playing with the math on that. You know, that $250,000 limit, that covers, I'm good. But you take a company like Apple with $20 billion on their balance sheet. And I did the math earlier because I'm dyslexic. I'm not smart enough to do it in my head. But it was about 80,000 bank accounts that they'd have to maintain insurance protection. That sounds like that might need to be addressed in some way. I don't know how we do that. But that might be a positive outflow. I'm trying to do the glass half full here. It might be a positive outflow from this.
You know, one of the other problems that was mentioned is this was the first time that a bank run came from Twitter. I mean, the problem wasn't so much. I mean, it was the fact that they were in long duration bonds. Yeah. They probably shouldn't have been in long duration bonds under the circumstances. But Twitter actually caused a frenzy of people going and asking for money. The real problem is people working themselves into a panic and having to go to ask for the money, just like they did on It's a Wonderful Life. People were wanting the money just because they were afraid they were going to be the last one in line.
Awareness. It's an awareness
thing.
That's
right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, if you just tuned in, we're having a discussion basically about what happened at the banking problems that we've seen in the last couple of weeks, and especially with the bank in San Francisco and all the issues there. And again, guys, I think you've done a great job. And I guess what I'm hearing, this is not the 08-09 crisis. And that if we don't panic and we don't go out here and go crazy and we don't lose our planning strategy, then we're probably going to move through. The Fed, Steve says, I mean, both of you guys have said the Fed have stepped in and kind of balanced things out. So we're not seeing this like what we're doing. So how does this say to us when we're going forward, what issues should we be thinking about in the next 30, 90 days?
Well, I mean, for number one, like you said, just everybody needs to take a deep breath. The banking system ultimately is built on trust. And the money's there. The debt, that the loans that have been made, that Dodd-Frank that you mentioned, Jim, all those regulations basically did a lot of work around who can borrow money. And if you look at the average credit score for borrowers now, it's so much better than it was. So this is not a problem of like all this money's been loaned out to people who aren't worth loaning money to. It's not that. It's that last year, interest rates went up 1,800%. And this is the ripple effect. It devalues bonds on your balance sheet, my balance sheet, and a bank's balance sheet. And so we just have to kind of get through this period of time. It's just a choppy time.
Well, when you think about the Fed raising rates at the fastest pace in U.S. history, from 0% to 4%, there are consequences. And again, Silicon Valley Bank is one of those consequences.
There you go.
What I hear you say is we need to settle down, take a deep breath. That's important. Well, guys, I tell you, you know, if you just tuned in again, I've got Steve Anderson, Ted Miner, and Scott Jordan. We're walking through some of these issues that we talk about and always listen to things that are so critical. Let me give you kind of an example of this in history. In one Capitol Hill appearance in 1983, a senator remarked that his colleagues had blamed Fed Chairman Paul Volcker for just about everything except for herpes and giving away the Panama Canal. Then they said, But we're not through with the hearings yet. So, you know, it's kind of history repeats itself. So stay with us, because when we come back, Ted Miner is going to help us to understand some income strategies when it comes to retirement. It's all part of what's going on in our economy. It's all about the reality that we got a mild recession coming. The bear market's going to hit a low, and there will be a new bull market. You want to know what kind of income strategy you need to have. Ted's going to help us through that, walk us through that whole process. Stay with us. I'm Jim Shoemaker. This is Talk Money.
This material represents an assessment of the market environment at a specific point in time and is not intended to be a forecast of future events or a guarantee of future results. This information is not investment advice or recommendation. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Investments will fluctuate and when redeemed may be worth more or less than when originally invested. Separate from the financial plan and our role as financial planner, we may recommend the purchase of specific investment or insurance products or accounts. These product recommendations are not part of the financial plan, and you are under no obligation to follow them.
Helping you make the most of your money. Talk Money with Jim Shoemaker on News Talk 98.9.
Financial professionals do not provide specific tax or legal advice, and this information should not be considered as such. You should always consult your tax or legal advisor regarding your own specific tax or legal situation.
Neither Shoemaker Financial nor Securian Financial Services are affiliated with Dr. Jim Whitmire, Mid-America Baptist Theological Seminary, or Crossroads Baptist Church. The views and opinions expressed are those of Dr. Jim Whitmire only and have not been presented on behalf of or endorsed by Securian Financial Services, Inc. or Shoemaker Financial.
Helping you make the most of your money. It's time for Talk Money. Now, your host, Jim Shoemaker.
Welcome back. I'm Jim Shoemaker. My guest today, Scott Jordan, Ted Miner, and Steve Anderson. We've been talking about, we answered actually Bert's question at the very beginning of the program. Then we got into the banking issues of all the problems going on, and we've decided that it's not that big of an issue. Steady the course. Don't panic. Just stay with your strategy. And now I've got Ted Miner, and we talk about strategy. He's going to talk about a retirement income strategy. But before I do that, I want to remind you, we mentioned Barclays Aggregate Bond Index, where you cannot, you know, invest in an unmanaged index. And so understand that investors cannot invest in an index. That's always important to remind you to do that. We may mention that during the program, but it's not something that we can go and actually purchase an investment inside of an index. It's important for to know that. Ted, I tell you, you always bring extremely valuable information. And today, this thought of an income strategy that's suitable for a person during retirement to meet their needs is extremely interesting and very valuable for us to understand.
Jim, if you think about it, if you just talk about income in general, even when you're working, you know, most people have an income that they pretty much know what it is throughout the course of the year. They may get a raise at the end of the year, but it's dependable. It's coming in. That's something they live with, and people kind of like that. However, you've got a number of people, mostly in sales, that may have a job that's commission-based, where they really don't know how much they're going to make. May have an idea, but it's all based on what they do. Therefore, there's a probability it may be low. There's a probability it may be high. People live with bonuses during life. And so this fluctuation of income is a real thing that happens to, really percentage-wise, a few people in life. When you get into retirement, one of the things that has really been used in as a majority is investing in a stock market portfolio or a mutual fund portfolio based upon the risks of the clientele. That is problematic from an emotional standpoint to many of the clients that are out there, the many people that are invested, because they've never dealt with that. They've always had that income stream. Therefore, you know, when we have the things that are happening right now, had what happened last year, these people get very, very nervous. And so what Wade Fowle is actually one of the people that works with the American College of Financial Services, and they've done a study on retirement income style awareness. Otherwise, what type of program do you put together to invest someone's money to set up an income stream that satisfies that emotional content? we can talk all day about analytics, but there's a lot of emotion when it comes to money.
I think emotions is really one of the biggest drivers to a lot of people, and we talk about that a lot. So now let me make sure I understand. You're talking about that when a person is getting ready for retirement, for past 40 years they've worked, and their lifestyle is somewhat supported by their job, whether it be commissions, bonuses, income. You kind of manage your lifestyle with what you're doing. And, you know, the job kind of gives you that comfort and stability that all of a sudden you retire and that goes away.
Yeah. And even years ago, you go back years ago, even when you retired, most people had a pension and Social Security.
Exactly.
A fixed income again. And now the pensions have gone away. I think only about 7% of the companies out there now offer pensions. The 401ks become a much bigger part of that. 401ks go up, 401ks go down. Then when they get transferred and you're using them as your funding of your retirement, they go up, they go down, and that's what they plan on. So this is a completely different picture than most people have worked with when they've had a job.
So you're talking about the American College has come up with this retirement income style awareness. I like it. So here, help me with this. It's kind of finding a solution, I guess, that matches a person's former lifestyle in order to keep that lifestyle going. I say this a lot. If you've been accustomed to watching a 60-screen, flat-screen, color TV, you don't want to all of a sudden have to go watch a 14-inch black and white. Bottom line. So let's talk about what are these retirement income style awarenesses. What are you talking about here?
There are basically four parameters that they look at. Or two of them together is one, the probability of success, which is basically what the one that's being used today is called total returns. It's the returns a person may get in a portfolio and how they live off that. The contrary to that, the opposite to that, would be safety first. Otherwise, we don't want to take a chance on anything. So you look at all fixed income assets.
So that would be the two extremes.
That's the two extremes.
So total return and fixed income or protected income.
That's right. And when you think about it, when a person, part of everybody's or part of most people's is fixed income, because a portion of that is Social Security, a portion of that can be pension, and then the rest of it can be made up of that 401k they may have had or personal savings that they may have that's invested for revenue to supply income during their retirement period. And then the other one may be annuities or something like that that would give them that other fixed income part to have a completely income stream that's all fixed.
That makes a lot of sense. Scott, when we talk with the people, that's really one of the biggest issues. How do they see that? That's where they want to visualize that.
Yeah, there is. And I think one of the problems that has changed somewhat in recent times or recent months is with the safety first mentality, which, you know, a lot of clients appreciate that. But we've been in such a low interest rate environment that you really have to have a lot of assets if you want everything, you know, to come out on that safety first now. But with rising rates, I think that it becomes a little easier to allocate a portion to the safety first. But I think, you know, what Ted's hitting on here is very important, because, you know, more of that supplying that retirement income has fallen back on the individual with the disappearance of the pension plans. You know, people still have their Social Security, but the pension leg of that three-legged stool has kind of gone away. So it's more on the individual to take that savings that they've accumulated, whether it's in a 401k or however, and convert that into an income stream. And people have a lot of trouble with that.
Yeah, so just to make sure I understand, so the total return, if this is the style you prefer, total return would be essentially saying, I'm going to take all my invested money and just draw off of it.
That's right.
Okay. And so the protected income is the complete opposite, which is I have 100% income that's fixed.
Absolutely.
From various sources. Okay. So, and you're saying that most people have some combination of the two, but those are the, like, if you were surveying people, those are two of the style preferences that are there.
In the survey, 33% want the total return, 35% likes the fixed income.
Interesting.
And then there's two other ones.
Well, what are the two other ones? Now, you know, you've got me interested, guys.
Actually,
this is important. This is interesting.
Time segmentation.
Okay.
Which is, I think you know what that is.
He was riding that horse. He wouldn't even let me finish my statement.
We got to get all this in, Jim.
All right.
Time segmentation, which is, we do this. You set these buckets where where money that's going to be used in, say, a one-year time frame is invested differently than money you're going to be using out here 8 to 10 years later. And the money that's closer is much more conservative because you're not taking nearly as much chances with it as the money that's out here later. So this time segmentation is also an option.
Is that new, though? I mean, is that something that's been around for a while, or is it just now becoming popular, or what is that?
Well, you can make an argument, Jim, that a 60-40 portfolio even is time segmented because you got partially bonds in there. We know that. But he's breaking this down to be able to talk to people, and about 17% of the people like the time segment. The fact that they can know what next year is going to bring, because maybe they're sitting in cash for all their needs for next year. And so they don't have to think about making any changes to things.
Takes kind of the worry out.
That's right. Takes the worry out for the short term. Now, back to the income thing, we know the problems with the income streams is that, first of all, most pensions don't go up. Most pensions, when you get a pension, is fixed for 20 years. So security is a big part of it, but it goes up. A lot of times when you get an annuity income stream, a lot of those are fixed. So how do you deal with inflation a lot of times with a fixed income strategy? That's something that has to be done.
All right. You mentioned four. They said total return and income protection or protected income. That's the two extremes. You've now introduced time segmentation. What's number four?
Risk wrap, which is one that...
Oh, wow. That's a big name.
Well,
Risk wrap.
It's not
intuitive.
It is. And basically the difference between the risk wrap and the protected income is that risk wrap may use variable annuities, which gives you some probabilities, gives you some flexibilities in how the money's invested.
All right. The flexibility is critical. The products, we'll talk about that later. But, this is such a, we've run out of time. I mean, bottom line, guys,
as long as we still have money and we've run out of time, that's good.
That's the goal.
That's the purpose. That's the purpose.
The bonus. All right, guys. Well, I mean, perfect subject, though, but I need to move to this next segment, and we've got a guest that I want to introduce. But, guys, you've done a great job. Thanks, Ted, and I will just have you back because there's too much information. We're talking about retirement income style awareness, total return, risk wrap, time segmentation, and protected income. I tell you, I want to know more because it's just valuable information at retirement. We'll have you back, Ted. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, guys, Steve and Scott.
Great to be here, Jim.
You always do a great job. I'm going to move to this next segment because I want to talk to this individual, and I'll introduce him in just a second. We're going to shift kind of a little bit to something that's very personal to our city and our area. This is the Mid-America Passion Play, when you think about it. Well, and it has been an icon for this city for so long. We are privileged to have Dr. Whitmire, who really started this back, I'm going to go 76, I'll find out in a few minutes, but we're also having his son, Luke Whitmire, who plays Jesus in the Passion Play, and this is a privilege. We do this every year. It is something you don't want to miss. If you've never seen this, it starts March the 30th, runs through April the 2nd. It's at the Chapel of Mid-America Seminary campus. It's located at 2095 Appling Road, Cordova, Tennessee. I'll tell you more about how you can get tickets in a few minutes. But Dr. Whitmire, welcome to the program, sir.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You always do a fabulous job being here because this is a passion for you, I know. Luke, I'm impressed. I have to admit, man, you look like Jesus, so you got that part down great.
I hope I do.
You do.
Thank you.
You do, and I know you do a great job with it, and so it's good to have you guys with us. And I got also Ted Miner. Ted Miner stayed over from the segment that we were talking about earlier because he's a part of the Mid-America Passion Play. Ted plays, has played a part in the past. Ted, what have you played in the past?
I've been Peter in the past.
Peter,
this year I'm just singing in the pit.
Singing in the pit. Yeah, we'll talk about the pit in a minute. But Jim Whitmire, you have just been an icon, a pillar of this community for so long. And when did you actually, and I think it didn't start out as the Passion Play, it started out as Living Pictures.
That's right. We started with the Singing Christmas Tree at Bellevue in 1977, and then we started the Living Pictures in about 1980, and it was done with a scrim to where we acted in front of the scrim, and then a scrim is a piece of fabric that once it's stretched, if you shine a light on it, it's opaque, but when you shine a light behind it, it comes through. And so we did that at Bellevue until we moved to the new church in 89. And then it became sort of like a just a big performance without a curtain, and everything is on stage, and we didn't use the scrim anymore. So it became more of a open amphitheater.
And so the Passion Play, when you say the Memphis Passion Play, what are we talking about?
We're talking about the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. This is something that has been acted out since Jesus was on earth. We know back in the 10th, 11th, and 12th centuries of farmers who actually put scenery and actors on wagons and would take them to the next city and act out the Passion Play during Easter. A lot of times they would have it on the steps of the cathedrals because the people couldn't read, but they could watch the stories being acted out on the steps of the temple.
So it's 12th century TV, you might say, or streaming, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. But that would have been a phenomenal thing if you're watching actors really telling the story of Jesus Christ, of the life, the times, the period, the actors doing all that, death, burial, and the resurrection, our redemption. So critical to not only back then, but to today, and for a lot of people, this is probably one of the best ways to actually visualize what you're talking about, that the Bible talks about in all the Gospels.
Well, it is, and children love it. They love the colors. They love the dancing. Of course, it's a live orchestra and singing.
But how many people involved?
We have almost 200.
200.
Plus with the orchestra, cast, and pit.
I'm talking with Dr. Whitmire, and he is the director of the Memphis Passion Play. And again, just to remind you, if you would like to pick up some information about that, you can go to midamericapassionplay.org to learn more about what you can find there. And we'll tell you in just a minute how you can get tickets. And it's still got tickets available for you. And just letting you know, it's March the 30th through April the 2nd at Mid-America Seminary. Phenomenal. Luke, you play Jesus.
Yes, I do.
That's an enormous responsibility. I know you do a fabulous job. And I think for me, the visualization of seeing the crucifixion and understand the agony and all that is so critical, whether we're talking to children at 6 years old or to an adult at 60, that is kind of what we need to see and understand what it means for us.
Right. Yeah, that was one of the biggest facets of this Passion Play that I really talked to my dad about when he kind of threw me into this role. But it's pretty intense what we represent. I told my dad from the very beginning, I really don't want to sugarcoat this production. And I love the theater, and it is one of the first forms of communication. And so it's a wonderful way to present that. So I do a lot of stuntman stuff, and so I really kind of bring that realism. I have to really work with the volunteers to kind of get that choreographed right. But every year when people come in and witness this production, they are really kind of blown away by the realism that we add. But that's really, really important to me to get that right, especially that aspect of it.
I think that is critical. It's so important. Yeah. And again, you can read about it, but when you see it and see it in, you know, in a production,
right.
I mean, I hate to refer to it as a production, but it is a production.
Yeah.
And Dr. Whitmire, you've always held true to the gospel. You don't vary it. It's true to exactly what the gospel is saying. That is so critical, so important for us to understand that too, that we're not just a production. This is this is the gospel presentation of the death, the burial, and the resurrection of Jesus
and
Christ.
And 90% of what we say is scripture.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Just right out of the Bible.
Exactly.
All right, the pit choir. I mean, you know, Peter, you've been put into the pit. So now, Ted, tell me what it means to be in the pit. I think, we're going to disclose some insider information here. There's all these actors on the stage. They're all singing. But to make it really come out balanced, there has to be a pit choir.
I'm just one of many that's singing in a back room trying to present that to the people that's out there. We have there's a full-blown orchestra right in front of the stage, and the pit choir's in a whole other room singing. And it's actually live. It's live coming out in the auditorium.
Now, we could pre-record all of that and use click tracks, you know, but it keeps to me, I like to use live people. There are about 50, maybe 60 people back there, and they each have their own mic and a headset. They're watching a closed-circuit TV, and they're watching my direction. There's a camera that's on me.
On you, watching everything. It's just, yeah. It's amazing, but it's all part of it. Luke, I want to ask you this question. As you play Jesus, what touches you the most in this whole thing?
Oh, gosh. I think the love and the compassion that they see in the life of Jesus Christ. I think the realism that we display on stage, the passion, all the different facets that go into this theater, like the lights, the sound, the orchestra. All these are like colors, in my opinion. And so when you do all these colors in good taste, it's amazing how this gospel of Jesus Christ can really accentuate the lives out there watching this. And so I think that's what really, really, really blesses them is how we do it, how we present it. Yeah,
I think that's critical.
You know, when Luke is quoting the script, of course, a lot of the whole script is Luke saying Jesus' words from the scripture, but this is kind of an inside story. When I played one of the disciples, many times when he's up there on stage and it's quiet and he's in the shadows and we hear Luke is quoting scripture the whole time. Mm. He's quoting either lines he's getting ready to do or lines he's done in another passion play, or they're from Luke or they're from John or something, but he's staying in character the whole time, quoting scripture up there on that stage, even when the mic's not on.
You know, I think we don't appreciate the fact that this is, to some people, maybe the only way they'll ever see and really understand the compassion, the love, the genuineness of Jesus Christ. I mean, this is not a figment of our imagination. This is a real person, all God, all man, that sacrificed for us. And this is what we're saying through this passion play. Jim, we can't thank you enough for what you've done for
the last
40 years. I mean, this is not new to you. And Luke, to follow in his footsteps and be a part of that and doing that. And just, it's a blessing for all of us. We appreciate the dedication, the determination, and your passion for what you do.
Thank you. Appreciate this.
Thank you so much.
And Ted, it's good to have you, man, in Pit Choir.
You want me to sing right now?
No.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. All right.
If you come Easter, you'll hear him.
Come Easter. Just to let you know, here's how you order tickets. You just simply, if you want to go online, this is simple to do. Go to MidAmerica Passion Play, midamericapassionplay.org. You can order your tickets there. There's still some available. Reminder, March the 30th. Through April the 2nd. It's at Mid-America Seminary on their campus in their chapel. You don't want to miss that. This is put on by the Crossroads Baptist Church. And let me give you that telephone number. If you're challenged to get it, can't get it through the website, you can call them. They'll give you tickets. That telephone number is 901-309-7777. 901-309-7777. Guys, you don't want to miss it. I can just tell you, if you haven't seen it, make it something. If you've seen it before, come and see it again. It's always, always worth just to see the death, the burial, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Well, let me change course again a little bit here. I've got Steve Anderson back in the studio with me, and I just really wanted to close out today's program because really there's so much going on in with the market. We've heard from Powell this week and all the things going on there. Mild recession. A bear market low coming, new bull market, all that's in the future. But right now in the nasty now and now, we get shaken up a little bit. We're prone to panic. And I wanted Steve to kind of dive in and kind of guide us through why we should not panic. So Steve, close out this whole thought process. How do you stabilize your clients when all this stuff's going on?
So the first thing I would say is don't minimize how real it is to be emotional. I mean, Ted was talking earlier about, you know, you shift from making money all these years, now it's time to start spending money, so it's emotional watching your money go up and down. So there's nothing wrong with that. But the trick is we have to talk to ourselves, right? In order to get from COVID with all the stimulus and all the stuff that happened in the economy to the other side, which hopefully is sooner than later, we've got to go through this period of choppiness. We're just getting things back to normal. So this, even though it's scary, this always had to come. So it's just, it's the hard work that has to be done to get everything right before we move to the other side. But the good news is, it was always coming, and we're closer to the end now than the beginning. So that's the best way, I think, to think about this.
I appreciate the way you say it. So mild recession, probably going to hit a new bear market low, but yet, as you said, here comes a new bull market.
That's right.
It just
that's
makes
right.
a cycle.
That's right. It's a cycle that repeats over and over again.
So well said. Thank you, sir. I appreciate you closing out. I want to thank my guests, Dr. Whitmire and Luke Whitmire, Steve Anderson, Scott Jordan, and Ted Miner. If you have questions for Dr. Whitmire, you want to pick up those tickets at Crossroads Baptist Church, 901-309-7777. Or you can, of course, go online to midamericapassionplay.org. You can find our program, Talk Money, at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Search for Talk Money with Jim Shoemaker. Subscribe. We appreciate it. If you have questions, type them to Jim, J-I-M. And, of course, that's on the text line, 901-683-0989, or Talk Money at ShoemakerFinancial.com. Next week, my guest, Dane Williams, is going to talk about what's going on in the home and auto insurance industry today. Frank LaCarica, annuities, what you need to know. And Scott's back. He's going to talk about headlines and your portfolio. That's Saturday morning at 7 a.m. and Sunday at 9 a.m. I want to thank my producer. Always does a great job, Todder Springs. Guest and content coordination, Francis Fortner. Production and marketing assistant, Lord Norsworthy. And our compliance officer, Tommy Armstrong. Thanks so much for listening. We're here every week helping you make the most of your money. I'm Jim Shoemaker. This is Talk Money.
Variable annuities have additional expenses such as mortality and expense risk, administrative changes, investment management fees, and rider fees. Variable annuities are subject to market fluctuation, investment risk, and loss of principal. Jim Shoemaker, Ted Miner, Scott Jordan, and Steve Anderson are registered representatives and investment advisor representatives of Securian Financial Services, Inc., securities dealer, member FINRA, SIPC, a registered investment advisor. Shoemaker Financial is independently owned and operated.
Helping you make the most of your money, this has been Talk Money with Jim Shoemaker on News Talk 98.9.